back to the 9-8 podcast, the home of progressive and underground music right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and every fortnight I'm joined by Dave Ellis. Hello, Dave.
G'day, g'day. Happy Tool Day.
Oh, you had to open with that, didn't you? Hey, speaking of your mate Matt needs to tell me where I need to send that money too.
Oh yeah, good point. I'm actually seeing him in a couple of days, so I'll tell him
to tell me where I need to send my $100. Yep. And I'll get that sorted.
Mm. There were a couple other people who actually took that up as well, so we'll get the information through to those guys as well as to where they can send their monies as well.
Fantastic.
So
which leads nicely into our first piece of follow-up.
I was going to say.
Which was about we spoke last time about the Tool record being leaked 4 or 5 days beforehand, and we had a bit of follow-up here from a friend of the show, Craig Bishop. He was talking about the fact that he had received a high-resolution download several days before the record came out due to CD Universe in the States being unable to fill their physical orders here in Australia because of all the lovely shipping laws and GST and all the sorts of nonsense that goes on down here.
Don't even get me started on that. They've applied all that now to eBay and everything. It's a pain in the ass.
Oh yeah. Well, Amazon have set up their own walled garden inside Australia where you can only buy stuff, and if you want to buy it from anywhere else, they go, nope, we can't ship here. Screw you. Go to the Amazon Australia website.
Or you just, we've spoken about this before on the podcast, just get a postage box in the USA, like I have.
Yep.
So,
yeah, or you can't even VPN your way around it either, actually, which is really annoying.
No, but you can, you can access Amazon.com. That's fine. And you can look at all the stuff that they've got there and everything like that, but you can't ship any of it to Australia. So you can ship it to a location in the US. Which is what I do because, like, I was on the site the other night. I think Guitar Center.
Yeah, you were talking about this before with guitar strings. Like, the guitar strings are 3 times more expensive here in this country than they are in America because Logic.
Oh, dude, yeah, I know, because Logic, exactly right. I mean, I play Ernie Ball. I've been playing Ernie Ball since I've always played Ernie Ball. I used one type of other strings once on my electrics, and I will never use them ever again. And the set of strings that I use here in Sydney, the street price on them is about $16 a set. I can buy a set of 12 shipped from the US for $55. And I mean, one set over here is, you know, street price is about $16-17. So why wouldn't you? You know?
Oh, a 12 pack. So like a 12 pack of six, so 12 lots of six strings.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it's huge difference.
Oh, it is. It's ridiculous.
And I've got friends that are going over to the States on Thursday, actually. They fly out Thursday. And they're like, do you want us to bring you back anything? I'm like, all the strings. So
go into a guitar center and buy. Here's what I want. Get all of them.
Now, I know what you thought. I want you to give me all the strings you have.
Yeah.
But it is a bit ridiculous. And that's... Yeah, obvious. I mean, when you've got companies like CD Universe in the States and such not being able to fulfill orders here in Australia, that's just ridiculous. The other source of the leak that I saw was actually the guy on Reddit who for some reason got it early. And then it was a really cool and weird story. His computer doesn't have a CD drive. So he was like, well, I can't rip this or anything like that. And also I don't know how. So, and then all these people on Reddit were saying, just come to Las Vegas. There's this guy who was staying in the strip at a hotel. And he said, come to me, I'll rip this thing and we'll give it out to people. And he was like, okay. So he drove to Las Vegas, 2 hours to Las Vegas to give this CD to this guy so that he could rip it and put it online.
Holy shit. It would have been quicker just to go to a place and like buy an external CD drive or something.
Yeah.
I mean, the computer not having a CD drive, that's not that unusual. The laptop I'm currently recording this podcast on doesn't have a CD drive in it.
Yeah.
So the big tower PC that I have sitting next to it does though, but that's,
My tower PC does, but none of my laptops have a CD drive.
You know. This was where just a down of a tangent sideways, this is where Neil Morse came up with his waterfall app from. He gave his new CD to his daughter to listen to, and his daughter was like, I don't have a CD drive and neither does my car. How am I supposed to listen to this?
Yeah. I know. I had a rental car for the last couple of weeks because my car was in getting some work done to it. And thank God it had Bluetooth, because I don't have a, I don't have CDs. I don't carry CDs with me or anything like that. So it had Bluetooth. I could connect up and I could listen to Spotify and all that sort of stuff, which is generally handy. How I do it anyway in my car.
Yeah.
But
it didn't even have an auxiliary port. Usually there's an auxiliary cable, an auxiliary outlet buried in the car, buried in the sound system somewhere.
Possibly it had an auxiliary port. I don't know. I didn't really go searching for it. As soon as I saw it had Bluetooth, I was like, game, done.
Yep, you know? Done.
But that was one of my stipulations when I picked up the car. I said, it's got Bluetooth, right? Yeah, okay, cool. You know.
So yeah, I think Bluetooth is mainly for these days, so it's like hands-free for mobile phone usage and stuff, so
that,
if you can take a call or whatever.
Well. Yeah, that helps a lot.
Yeah, see, my car doesn't have that because it's really old.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think that about covers follow-up. So let's jump into the news, and the big news item that we have to announce right here on the Night Out podcast, as of time of recording, this hasn't actually officially been announced yet, but it will be by the time this has been recorded. Neil Morse is coming to Australia, people. Woo! Rejoice.
I am super happy. Well, Hoggy and I found out this a couple of weeks ago, actually, from...
Don't say who.
From a friend of the show. This friend of the show said, hey, look, you can't say anything, all right, but this is happening.
This is happening.
We've been sitting on it for about 3 weeks. It's been in my diary for 3 weeks as super secret gig that I can't tell anyone about.
Seriously, it's been in the same. Mine as well. It's been like secret prog show and the two dates.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So the two dates
right.
are Neil Morse will be playing in Sydney on January the 30th and he will be playing in Melbourne on February the 1st. He's playing in Sydney at the Crowbar, I think.
Yeah, which is a weird choice for a venue.
Yeah.
For an acoustic show, I mean... For Neil Morse, you know, like you'd expect it to be somewhere else, not.
It's probably whatever was available. It's like wherever they can get him in, I suppose.
Maybe, but I don't know. Crowbar's a bitch to get to, and it's frankly not that great a venue. That's a lie. It's a good venue for rock gigs and all that sort of stuff. but for an acoustic gig, I just don't know how it'd go. I don't know. Anyway, that's just me. But where they're playing it down in Melbourne is a good place. That is a good venue. Very good venue.
Yeah, where they're playing it at the Evelyn Hotel.
Yeah.
In Fitzroy. You've played at this gig or you've seen
I've been there and I've seen stuff there. It's a good venue.
Now, there's been some comments made online already about, why isn't the whole band coming? Why are we only getting Neil Morse? Let me put that to bed right here, right now. I've seen Neil Morse perform acoustically in Europe. He did some acoustic stuff at the Neil Morse Band show that I saw in Hamburg in 2015. You're not missing, it's not like a lesser, in giant air quotes, experience just because he's playing acoustically. The show is fantastic. For Christ's sake, buy a damn ticket.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tickets are $66. If you want the VIP experience, that'll be $168. Mm-hmm. And for that, you get a meet and greet with Neil Morse, soundcheck access, an A3 tour poster, and a VIP laminate. I have an A3 tour poster from when I paid to see the meet and greet for the Neil Morse Band in Hamburg. The poster's fantastic. It's all very nice. The VIP laminate will be good. Soundcheck access, I can't imagine anyone wanting not to see soundcheck 100%. Access, especially for Neil.
That is
you
what... Know,
and you get a meet and greet with him. So
that is the main thing here, is the meet and greet thing, yeah, okay, cool. You're paying... I mean, I think paying an extra $100 for a meet and greet's bloody exorbitant anyway. I'm looking at you, Dream Theater, when you come over here and charge $250 for a fucking meet and greet on top of
that
the ticket. Also,
that included a ticket as well.
Yeah, I know.
And early access, so we're on the rail and all that sort of stuff.
The big thing is the sound check access for me, because being there and seeing them do the sound check and work out the problems and, you know, I've got this in my ear, this is going weird and all that sort of stuff, that's a really cool thing to see. And if you're a fan of music and you're a fan of live music particularly, it's a really, really interesting thing to pull back the curtain a little bit and have a look at exactly what's going on. Then again, I'm the guy that watches all the behind-the-scenes rig tours and things like that.
Who doesn't?
The thing that's really interesting I find about those is the guys who you would expect to have crazy setups never do, and the guys that you would expect not to have crazy setups almost always do. So, for example, I saw one, the most recent one with John Fogarty, right? And the guy, the sound tech, was like, it's a pretty simple setup, you know. He's got these and these and these. And, and here's his rack, and this rack's got this, it's like a double rack with all this shit in it and everything. It's like, what the fuck? How much gain does this guy run? He's like, when he's doing solos, he runs a lot. It's like, it's John Fogarty. What do you mean he runs gain? What is he? Seriously? And it's just
gain on the guitar or gain on his vocals?
No, he has like three pedals staged for his solos.
Damn.
And it's really, really high gain stuff, all right, which makes a lot of sense because he does a lot of work with like feedback and pushing the guitar right to its edge and things like that. But you just don't expect it from the guy who sings about Proud Mary. So, you know, it's really, really, really interesting. And then you get guys like Joe Bonamassa and you're like, dude, Joe Bonamassa, I mean, he's going to have a pedal board like you wouldn't believe. He doesn't.
Yeah.
He has a volume knob on a wah pedal.
And that's it.
That's it. And plugs straight into the front of the amp. You know, so it's really, really cool.
And then, of course, you get to guitar setups from guitar players who you would expect, who are a couple, like Adrian Belew's pedal board. I've never seen a pedal board the same, that size ever. It's like, it's fucking like, it's like a small dining room table, that thing.
Yeah.
Pedals everywhere and heaven knows what the hell, how the hell he sets it up. But
yeah,
I guess that's why he paid guitar techs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know the Edge, obviously, but I mean, everything he does is effects. So kind of makes sense.
It's all delay and reverb and everything.
It's huge. You've seen my desk. It's about twice the size of that.
Good Lord.
It's massive.
And he's like, is he actually pushing any buttons or tapping any pedals or anything? Or is that just the whole thing required to get just the sound?
No.
Or is he manipulating things and moving stuff around?
He's moving stuff around and like tapping things and all that sort of stuff. It's pretty incredible. It's, anyway, we digress. So,
yes, we do. But
with this Neil Morse thing, if you are a fan of seeing anything, the sound check access would be worth the extra $100. Like, hands down, I'd go for that.
If you haven't met him, it'd just be worth it if you'd like to have a photo with him and stuff like that.
I know, and that's part of it for sure. But even if it was just sound check access for $100, I'd pay the extra $100 to be there for sound check because it's awesome. Like, it's just really, really, really cool to see that stuff and to potentially be able to chat with the sound guys. And, you know, if you're an aspiring sound guy for gigs and such, there's nothing stopping you walking up to the sound guy and saying, hey, do you mind if I stand next to you and just watch what you do? And the guy will probably
keyword
be like,
there. Keyword watch.
Yeah, I was about to say, the guy will probably say, sure, just don't fucking talk to me or get me a beer.
Don't touch it. Don't touch anything.
Don't touch. Not touchy. But beyond that, I mean, it's incredible. It's an incredible opportunity. And people, the other thing I do want to say about this as well is if you don't go to this gig and then whinge and bitch and moan that he doesn't come to Australia with his full band, you are the problem.
Yeah.
So
now, to pull back the curtain slightly, the whole reason that this tour is happening at all is because Neil Morse just happens to be coming to Australia for a holiday with his wife. And when they said that he was coming here, so his booking agent got in touch with the promoter and said, hey, there's an opportunity here for Neil to play a couple of shows. Are you interested? And obviously the answer was yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So here we are. There will be some support acts on the night. Those aren't getting announced until later on in the year. Yeah. When they do get announced, you'll hear it here.
Although I'm fairly certain we know who one of them is, but we can't say anything at the moment.
Yeah. Nothing confirmed as yet, but when it will be confirmed. And if you're at all interested in what sort of stuff is he going to be playing, I'm going to throw a link in the show notes to a set list from a show he did in Germany last year. This tour is sort of like an extension of the Life and Times tour he did through Europe, which was just, again,
excellent.
him and his guitar and keyboards. So I'm going to throw a link into the show notes to that. That set list is pretty representative of what you're probably going to get. So we'll put a link to that. So if you're at all interested in, what's he going to be playing, have a look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely worth checking that out. Now, you've got something in here as well, moving on.
Yes. Another big prog artist that is coming to tour here in Australia, Martin Barr. Now, those of you who are not familiar, I think, who is Martin Barr? Martin Barr, for years and years and years, was the guitar player with Jethro Tull. He's going to be coming to Australia with I'm not. It's not billed as Jethro Tull, but he was in Jethro Tull for so long. So let's just, for all intents and purposes, call it a Jethro Tull tour. He's coming to Australia. He's playing across Australia. He's playing a couple of shows here in Perth, which is fantastic. And he's playing in all the other major cities as well. Tickets have been on sale for this for a little while already. He'll be playing in Marrickville at the Factory Theatre on the 20th of November. Islington at the Small Ballroom on the 21st. The Blue Mountains Theatre in Springwood on the 22nd. It appears those two have actually been sold out already, which is interesting. Well, I can't buy tickets for them, so either they haven't been announced yet or they're already gone. He's playing at Fortitude Valley on the 24th. Now, that's in Brisbane, isn't it? Fortitude Valley.
Yeah, isn't that it? Fortitude, yep. Fortitude is the protected music zone.
Oh, fantastic.
Yep.
He's playing in St Kilda on the 27th, Richmond on the 28th, Hindmarsh on the 29th. He's playing, and then he's playing two shows in Perth, one at Bar One in Hillary's on the 30th, and then one in Fremantle on the 1st of December.
Gorgeous.
Fremantle one appears to be sold out already. There's a very good reason why they're playing two shows here in Perth. Up here in the north of Perth, where I live, there is a surprisingly large British community, so he figures if he puts a gig up here, he might be able to drag a few people down from the lawless northern suburbs of Perth, where all the Poms live. I'm not even joking. It's like Little Britain. Once you get up to like Mindari and Quinns, it's just like wall-to-wall Brits. It's insane.
That's remarkably interesting. It's kind of like St. Ives in Sydney, where it's all just South Africans.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you get up there and it's just often
I'm assuming there are various suburbs in Sydney as well that are sort of predominantly sort of from Asian communities, Vietnamese, Chinese, etc.
Yeah. Hurstville's one. You've got Chatswood, Cabramatta. Yep. Bankstown's quite high in Vietnamese now. It used to be sort of Lebanese and sort of all that area, and now it's sort of more Asian.
Interesting. All right, so there we go. So there's a couple of big prog tours coming up in the coming months.
Absolutely.
For Christ's sake, buy tickets, please.
Yeah.
Come on.
Absolutely.
People have staked a lot of money on this, you know.
They absolutely have. One thing I do
and
want to
people, and people complain. Oh my god, people complaining about. I don't know. I've said enough about people complaining about the economics of touring. Why are they coming to Perth? It's like, oh, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I know.
There are very specific circumstances as to why Neil Morse is playing where he's playing. Just live with it.
Yeah, exactly. Asked and answered, guys. Asked and answered. One thing I do want to mention as well here, another piece of news that's happened during the week. for those guitarists of you that are listening to the show, the site's agreement is being modified so that it no longer includes musical instruments. Now, CITES is otherwise known as the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna. The aim of the particular thing is to make sure that, wild, rare timbers and so on and so forth can't be used or overlogged, and it's been affecting, because there's a whole bunch of certifications and shit that's had to have happened in the US and such, and it's been affecting guitar prices and guitar import and export rates and such, most notably with Gibson. Gibson had a big thing about it in about 2011.
Oh, yeah, well, that was with the government series guitars, wasn't it, where they had some wood impounded?
Yeah.
And so then they had to get the wood back, and then they decided to make a limited run of guitars out of it for funsies.
That's where sort of it all sort of started to really kick off. I mean, the actual thing was in the mid-70s or something. The CITES agreement was originated in like the mid-70s or something. But, you know, America being America, they never really had anything enforced against them. So now things have been sort of enforced, and for the last couple of years they've been experimenting with a whole bunch of different stuff. So instead of using, you know, Brazilian rosewood and so on and so forth to make their fretboards, they've been doing things like baked maple and, you know, all this sort of stuff. Which, frankly, I think doesn't. To be really honest with you, and I'm pulling the veil back, the curtain back a little bit here, I suppose. I don't think tone woods actually make all that much of a fucking difference, to be really honest with you. I think it's the shape of the guitar, the pickups that you've got, and the fingers that are using it, frankly.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd probably suggest that it's probably 90% person using.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, user based.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, if anyone has seen, I mean, for an example of this, if anyone has seen Zakk Wylde play NIB by Black Sabbath on a Hello Kitty guitar, that pretty much says everything I need to say about that one.
100%. But yeah, so anyway, Guitar players rejoice. Sights is coming to an end for musical instruments, which is awesome, which means hopefully we'll see some reduction in prices. That being said, I was talking to a mate of mine who is involved with the Gibson distribution chain here in Australia, and I asked him whether or not, hey, you know, does this mean Gibsons are going to be cheaper? And he just went, no, probably not. Because of course not, because
Australia tax.
Why would they? Yeah, exactly. Australia tax. So exactly. Anyway, sites. If you want to read up on that, we'll shove a link in the show notes to the actual sites, the sites website, and you can have a look at that.
All right. Now you've got something here in the show notes about Neo Relic.
Yeah.
Now, what happened there?
Okay, so Diana from Neo Relic posted something on Facebook, and I got in touch with her pretty well straight after she put it on Facebook. Long story short, she had her car broken into and had her in-ear monitors, a microphone, I think, and her wallet and a couple of little things inside the car and such stolen. And it was right out the front of the Bendigo Hotel in Melbourne.
This seems to be happening more and more often.
It seems to be happening more and more often. I want to put something out as a working muso and someone who has worked in the music industry for quite some time. First things first, don't load out. Don't load your gear out, right? That's the first biggest warning I can give you.
For the non-musicians in the audience, what are you talking about here when you say don't load out?
So when you finish a gig at the end of the evening, you're loading in is when you're bringing all your shit from your car or your van or whatever into the venue. Loading out is putting it back in the car, basically. But what happens more often than not, particularly in small gigs and such, the venue will turn around to you and say, you've got to load out now. So take your stuff and put it in your car. And it's like 7 o'clock
this happened,
in the evening.
This happened at Progfest, actually. There was like that they had to immediately like clear their gear out, and we were recording an interview with Hashashin, and Lachlan was like, "Oh yeah, we're gonna have to like load our gear out into the cars now and get it out of here because we're being told to because they haven't got enough room to keep it all backstage and they need to get more people in and da da da."
That's right. Mind you, that was total bullshit because they had an entire third room they could have used, but. Anyway, that's another thing. I'm not saying that Lachlan or anyone is lying. I'm just saying that, you know, this is the case with the venues, right? So I remember when Nothing Like You, we were playing down in Melbourne and we played at a whole lot of Love Bar. And you were supposed to finish your set and load out immediately, and I just flat out refused. And the publican came over to me, or the bar manager, and he said, mate, you got to load your stuff out. I said, I'm not loading it out. I'm not putting, you know, $10,000 worth of guitars in a car that's down around the corner that I can't see. Not doing it.
Yeah.
Unless if it gets stolen, can I come back to you to claim the money? Is that all right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I bet the answer was they're in their way there.
I said, cool, put them behind the bar and they won't be in the way. Oh, no, we can't do that. Cool, then leave them the fuck where they are. You know? And it's just you've got to have that spine, I suppose, to actually stand up next to these guys and say, no, fuck you, that's my stuff. Touch it, I'll break your arms to begin with. Secondly, they get really testy with it.
Or just like venues. If you're going to be having musicians there regularly, 100%. Have somewhere you'd be like, hey, cool, guys, you could put your gear in this room here. It's behind a locked door. No one's going to break in and steal it. Shove it in there. Load out when you can. Exactly. Load out when you can.
Exactly. But what that doesn't stop is it doesn't stop people from obviously breaking into cars when there is stuff in there and such. And my heart goes out to Diana, it really does, because I know, A, how hard she's worked to afford the stuff she's got, and the stuff that she had was not exactly cheap. We're talking some good Sennheiser in-ears and Sennheiser microphones and everything like that. You know, all reasonably high-end stuff. And some scumbag decides to go and steal it, probably so he can go and buy some heroin.
Or just steal it because he can.
Yeah, exactly. Or just because you're a piece of shit and you steal stuff. But I suppose I want to use the time on the podcast as well to say if you saw anything at the Bendigo Hotel, because it was right outside the venue, you know, please get in touch with either us and I'll put you on to Diana, or get in touch with Neo Relic directly and speak to Diana and try and help her get her stuff back, because I know what it's like to – I have fortunately never had anything stolen from me, and no guitars or anything like that, but I have lost stuff before and I know what it's like. and it's a pain in the ass. So I think that just about does it for our news section.
Yes, it does.
Which means we're on to our main topic.
Yes, we are. The thing that I suspect many of you are probably here waiting for us to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Which is Tool, Fear Inoculum, Track by Track.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you're probably going to be doing most of the talking here, Dave, because I have some rather strong opinions about this record, which we'll probably get to a bit later. But let's start with the positivity and the fun. What do you think of this record, Dave?
Being a big Tool head, it's kind of surprising that I love it, and I do. I've no word of a lie. I reckon I've listened to this album start to finish now. Bear in mind, it was released on Friday, which was 3-4 days ago as of recording, at the time of recording. I've listened to this album probably about 8 or 9 times now from start to finish, which doesn't sound like much, but when you consider that I've been working the last few days.
I was going to say, you've managed to listen to a record 9 times in 4 days?
Yeah.
What, it was 4 days? Yeah. 4 days? Mm-hmm. That's insane.
Yeah. I absolutely fucking love it. It's just, it's mind-bendingly good. Mind-bendingly good. And I think it's going to be one of those albums where you get a lot of people, because it's stirred up a lot of emotions on the internet, right? So there's a lot of people who are saying, oh, it's amazing, like me. And then you got all the other people who are going, no, it's shit. Like, you know, people arguing on the internet and such. They do that.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of people out there saying, oh, this is rubbish.
Yeah.
You know, cooked up demos, all that sort of thing. And I probably fall more into the second camp than the first one, but not quite as strongly as some.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think it's probably going to be one of those albums that grows on people. For the people who,
yeah, I've only listened to it probably 2 or 3 times.
Yeah. And
so, yeah.
I think the thing for me that's so amazing about it is that it sounds exactly like Tool. It sounds exactly what you would expect Tool to sound like. But at the same time, it sounds completely not like Tool at all. Because
really? How so? You're much more familiar with the Tool back catalog than I am. So how is it?
It sounds a little bit more refined.
To me, it sounds like Tool by the numbers, but that's just me.
It sounds a bit more refined than their previous work, which could also just simply be the fact that, you know, they're recording it in 2019/18 as opposed to 2005.
And also as well, they took years to record this record, so they had plenty of time to like go back and re-record stuff and tighten things up and do this, that and the other.
Oh, exactly.
You know, if it came out and sounded like four guys bashing around in their garage, you'd be like, really, you spent that long to make this? So I don't think the fact that it's kind of, you know, more refined doesn't surprise me.
I suppose hearing it, even from the first track that was released, which obviously was the title track, Fear Inoculum, once Maynard started singing, you know, because the last however many albums of Tool, all the albums of Tool have always had that, you know, strong Maynard, mid-rangey, punchy thing that he does. And then the second he started singing in this one, I think we knew it was something completely different, because he started in that high register. And honestly, when he started singing, I got goosebumps. I just went, wow, okay, cool, this is different. It was like he was bringing his influences from a perfect Circle into the Tool realm just enough. Like, not enough, because I think a lot of people were scared that it was going to sound like another A Perfect Circle album.
Which I think is rather mean, given that you've got 3 people in Tool who don't play in A Perfect Circle.
Yes, I agree. I think it's a bit mean as well.
Okay, lyrically, there may be some similarities or whatever, but musically, I think it'd be completely different.
And it is. It's completely different. It's got all the standard Tool hallmarks, you know, the polyrhythms and the big spacey droney bits and everything like that. And that's, looking back on it, that's actually what I love about Tool, is the fact that they can have these songs that are 15 minutes long and half of it's like this spaced out droney stuff, but there's enough going on in the background with all the little bits and the sprinklings of this and that everywhere. It doesn't leave you bored. you know, it's
Give me some examples of what you mean by it doesn't leave you bored. Maybe I just wasn't listening to it closely enough or whatever, because I found the whole thing to be just rather boring. But so this is your opportunity. Sell me on all the interesting parts of the record, and then we can do a follow-up later where I go back and listen to those parts in particular.
Sure. I think the vocals, I've already mentioned the vocals, but the vocals are absolutely fucking incredible, right? Lyrically, it's unbelievable. I mean, if you listen to Invincible, one of the lyrics in that is beating chest and drums, beating tired bones again, an age-old battle, mine, weapon out and belly in.
Beating chest and
right, that is a phenomenal picture to have in your head. You know, just you imagine this guy, this warrior, who's so tired of everything that's going on, but he keeps going. You know, he's got, because he has to.
Sounds almost like you could almost draw parallels between that and, say, gee, I don't know, rock and roll touring, for example.
Yeah, perhaps. You know, interestingly,
he's exhausted, he's tired, but hey, guess what? You've got another show tomorrow night and you better get up and go with that. Especially given, I mean, this one probably could be very well about him, because he puts a lot into his lyrical performances and performance on stage. Mm. Because of the stuff that he's singing about. So I could totally see how this could be potentially about him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the same song, you've also got the pre-chorus, which says, warrior struggling to remain relevant, warrior struggling to remain consequential. I mean, that could very well be about Tool as a band. Because it was a lot of talking about, you know, are these guys still relevant? And I think we even mentioned it on one podcast at one point.
Yeah, we totally did. You know, that lots of bands have sort of been influenced by Tool. Mm. Is it going to be a bit like Yes, for example, where there are a shitload of bands out there who were influenced by Yes and have taken that style of music into much more interesting places, and then we have Yes, who have basically done nothing to progress in 25 years and now just spend their time touring the back catalogue. But anyway.
Exactly. So, I mean, you've got lyrics like that, and then you've got lyrics like in Descending, the bridge section of that goes, sound the dread alarm through our primal body, sound the reveille, to be or not to be, rise, stay the grand finale, stay the reading of our swan song and epilogue, one drive to stay alive, elementary, muster every fibre, mobilise, stay alive. It seems like lyrically the band, and obviously Maynard, who I think writes the majority of the lyrics, if not all of them.
Pretty sure he writes all of them, yeah.
Is really looking at this going, this could be the last hurrah for Tool. Like, this could be it. So let's write about that. Fuck it. Let's do it, you know.
You think so, though? You think?
I don't know, mate. I really don't. The lyrics seem to point toward that more often than not.
Because you think about it, if we have to wait another 15 years for the next record, they're all going to be in their 70s.
Exactly. Exactly. And I don't think after this particular album, having such high hopes for the album and so on and so forth, and I think they've knocked it out of the park. Obviously, other people have a different opinion to me. What's next? You know what I mean? Like, it is. What can you do from here? There's probably not a lot where you can go.
And they're probably in the position as well where, you know, They're obviously not hurting for money, otherwise it wouldn't have taken 14 years to write a record. So they probably, it's not like they need to produce anything. They can write and release and do whatever, whenever the hell they feel like it.
Exactly, exactly.
So they're not exactly, they're obviously not hurting for money.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise it wouldn't, so they're in the rather envious position as artists of like, well, we're not entertained by any pressure to write, record, tour, like some other bands are. Anathema springs to mind.
Yeah, well, most other bands.
Yeah, I was going to say, Anathema in particular, because the Poor Bastards have been write, record, tour, an album every 2 years for the last 10.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And you know, how the hell they're still going at that level and, you know, touring at that level is, well, I don't know. Hey, I don't know how the hell they do
this. This is why Portnoy left Dream Theatre.
Because he was burnt out.
Because he was burnt out. So I understand it.
Yeah, they'd been write, record, tour non-stop since the early 90s. Mm,
exactly.
They never really had a break.
Exactly.
They just kept
going. I mean, other notable awesome bits in the album, as far as I'm concerned, you've got in the song Invincible at the 8 minute mark. Descending at the 10 minute 30 mark thereabouts. This is all these bits where the guitars come in and they do like this syncopated, awesome, like chunky bit or something like that. Tempest, just talk about Tempest. I'm going to park this as a song just for a second, but Tempest at the 7:40 mark. And Tempest at the 10:30 mark. Unbelievable. Those two parts of that song are incredible, and the whole song itself is, oh, it's probably the heaviest one on the entire album. The thrashiest, although it's not really thrashy at all. But fuck me, that is a weapon of a track. And it's one of those ones where you hear it and you just go, this is going to go off its nut live. Even though nothing on this album is really a type of song that, unlike 10,000 Days, you had The Pot and you had Vicarious and Jambi and all those sorts of almost like mosh heavy songs. Like
there's not really any anthem-y sort of moshy kind of stuff. This one,
no.
I think you could probably, it's more like a sort of a stand, it's more like a post-rock kind of performance where you just stand there and take in the whole sort of visual 100%. Thing that'll be going on.
Yeah.
The lights and the weird projections and, you know. Sort of almost like a Pink Floyd show in a way,
yep.
Where the musicians, they're kind of down there somewhere, but you've got this huge other big production thing happening around them.
Yeah, and having seen
Marillion are getting a little bit that way as well, actually. They're doing sort of big production-y type stuff where, you know, you're not really focusing too much on the musicians. It's more about the show thing happening around them.
And having seen Tool a couple of times...
Yeah, see, you've got one up on me here, as I haven't seen Tool.
See, I can see where this is going. Live, you know, so if you see them live, they have a massive light show, and I mean massive light show. Everything's all just lasers and lights and LEDs, and you know, the fact that Maynard stands at the back of the stage and he's kind of silhouetted against the screens at the back.
Oh, he does that with a Perfect Circle as well, actually. There was all like the same, similar sort of setup. The two guitar players were at the front, had the keyboards, yeah. And then Maynard was at the back behind the keyboard player, and it was like big bright white lights up in front of him. So you could see him, but you couldn't see his face.
Yeah.
He was just kind of there in silhouette.
Yeah.
And then when he wandered down the front of the stage to take a bow, that was the first time you actually saw his face. And he was, you know, had his weird hair and funny makeup and all the rest of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the first time. That was the first and last time you saw him at the show during the show was when he came down the front to take the bow. Now, have you had a chance to listen to any of the little instrumental pieces in the middle of it? Because at least on the version of the record that I have, the one that I've listened to, I don't have that, so I haven't actually listened to those parts. Yeah. So tell me more about those. What's in there that's
so
interesting? Because they haven't really done that. They've always done like sort of the song structure without these like little interludes in the middle.
So
what's up with that?
So there's four in total. There's track three, which is Litanie contre la peur. I'm probably butchering how to say that, but
it's French. Everybody it's butchers French. It. It's fine.
That's right. Legion inoculant, chocolate chip trip. And
that one is on, that chocolate trip that is on the physical version that I have. Yes. That's actually on the record. Yeah. So, but it's all these three other little 2 minute, 3 minute kind of tracks.
So they were
that
all
aren't
from,
on the record.
From what I understand, they were all written by one of the members of the band. So Chocolate Trip was Danny Carey's one. I think Litanie contre la peur was what's his face? The lead singer, Maynard.
Yeah, it was Maynard's. Okay,
it was Maynard's, I believe. Legion Inoculant, I think, was Justin Chancellor, the bass players, and Mockingbeat, I believe, was Adam Jones's.
Okay, interesting.
So the way they work, to be really honest with you, I don't think they add anything or take anything away from the album. I think they probably stand in here to be things that they can put on in between stuff. And I'm going back to the live shows. So,
it's almost like a Broadway show interlude thing where they can change stuff or, you know, change guitars or, you know, just have like a break from all the stuff.
Exactly. They can do the changing of guitars. You know, they can do all that. They can have some other little light show going on and things like that. This album really feels like an album to me that was built to be heard live. And all these little sprinkling little bits, the Legion Inoculant mocking beat and everything like that is all, I think, designed to have that as a large package. It feels to me, although I haven't quite figured out the concept yet, but it feels like a concept album. And I don't know why.
You think so?
Yeah. It feels to me like a concept album. And I don't quite know what the concept is.
I was going to say it's not a story thing.
No, but I think it's probably a thematic concept album, I think.
Well, apparently, according to Danny Carey, the original plan for the record was to have one song, one long song, and the little interlude parts come from the plan to have it as like one long song. So you have these like little interludes and then back into the thing again.
Yeah, there you go. See, I didn't know that, but it does make sense. And a lot of the songs do sound like they could be different sections of the song. I have to wonder, and this is me putting my tinfoil hat on, but I have to wonder whether or not, for example, maybe Fear Inoculum and Numa are from X era, and then Invincible is from the next era of them. And then Descending and Culling Voices is from this era, and then Tempest is this era. You know what I mean?
You think so?
I have to wonder because of the way they're structured and the way they're similar and so on and so forth, and even thematically with the lyrics and so on and so forth, they're sort of interplayed a little bit. So
it's interesting because if they've written the album mostly by jamming, it wouldn't surprise me if like one half of a song was married to another half of a song by two completely separate jams done 6 months apart.
Oh, probably, yeah.
Because that's how Marillion have done it. There's a, I forget which song it is, the Sky Above the Rain? I think it's, yeah, The Sky Above the Rain. The first half of the song came from one jam and the second half of the song came from another jam they did 2 years later. And they kind of, it was like, oh, these two kind of work together. And so they did that. So I wonder if that's part of it as well, like, or Maynard has a lyric and then they jam and then he kind of sings bits of, you know, this part of a lyric over this song. No, that doesn't work. Maybe this works. And then they come together with it. I don't know. It'd be very interesting to find out how they recorded the record. I'm assuming it's mostly through jamming.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's an incredible album. I mean, I know for a fact that they, over their time of recording, They've recorded more songs than what is actually on this. So it wouldn't surprise me if there was another album in the works as well. Of course, whether or not those songs match their standard, because I believe that's why most of them were dropped, because they weren't up to scratch, then, you know, we will see, I suppose, in the future as to what is actually going to be sort of coming out.
That's no surprise that they've recorded more music than goes on the record. You just record, you record everything because recording is really cheap. And then you go through it and you go, oh, well, like, you know, we'll have that bit, that bit, that bit, and put it together from there.
You know, I mean, the,
I'm sure Dream Theater have got hundreds of hours of stuff in the vault that they've like jammed to, and then they've decided, ah, that's not very good. You know, in the bin it goes.
Yeah, I mean, there's that, and there's also, I mean, again, tinfoil hat goes on. They've got six albums out now. Wouldn't surprise me if they were gonna finish it on maybe their seventh album. Because I know how much they love the number seven. So from me, I suppose, and I've talked a lot on this episode. this is honestly, it's better than I expected. I was kind of honestly expecting the album to be terrible. I was really excited for it because it's Tool, and why wouldn't you be excited for Tool? But I was kind of expecting it not to be anywhere near the level of what they've done. And I'm so happy that they've done so well on this album. Now, I've spoken enough. What are your reservations? That's what I want to know. I want to know what it is about this album that doesn't, aside from the fact that you like 70s prog with, you know, saxophones in it. what is it exactly about the album that sort of doesn't turn you on?
I don't know. It just kind of feels just the, I don't, maybe it was what I, how I was listening to it or something, but I was, I don't know. I was just expecting kind of more, like different, you know, a lot more different, time, like they're probably doing tricky time signatures as well. I don't know. I was just expecting more like instrumentation rather than just like drum beat and drone guitars. But
yeah,
maybe that's just me wishing. Maybe that's just wishing. Maybe that's just me wishing for too much.
Yeah, I mean that's. I suppose I can understand that, but I don't know. That's kind of what they've always been. The drums have always sort of taken a front seat. And the guitars and the bass and such have always been, I think this is one of the things I really like about Tool, is that they are not your normal, you know, the drums sit under everything and the bass sits under that and the, and then.
And the guitar guitars, drives everything along,
and then
yeah.
You've got the vocals on top, which is sort of sprinkling everything. With these guys, you can tell that the drums are very much, they drive everything and the other guys sort of lock in with that. Or in some cases don't lock in and play completely different time signatures over the top.
That's where the King Crimson influence comes in for Tool. For like Tool are very influenced by King Crimson. Like apparently like in the early days, like in the 2000s, King Crimson opened for Tool at one point.
Yes.
Not the current 9-man version they are, and this is the 4 or 5 people.
Yeah, that was the Lateralis tour.
What was that,
that
sorry?
Was the Lateralis tour.
Was it?
Yep.
Ah, okay. And then apparently Maynard made some crack. It's like, now you know who influenced us. Don't tell Robert Fripp.
Yeah.
So definitely like playing against the beat, that's a very King Crimson thing, especially with the track Indiscipline, which was created specifically for Bill Bruford to play against the beat in every single way he could possibly get away with. And they totally do that now when they play that live. You've got three drummers playing against the beat. One's playing in 3/4, one's playing in 10/8, and one's playing in 7, I think.
Yeah, wow.
It's fucking insane.
Well, when you listen to parts of this new album as well, there are parts where the drum's playing right on the beat and then the bass is playing the offbeat, but the guitar is accenting on the different sections. So it's, you know, it's so hard to explain it without sounding like a complete idiot trying to do it with your mouth.
Or having to chart it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Like trying to,
exactly.
You know, yeah.
And this is the thing I really like about Tool is on the surface, you look at their stuff and you go, that's not that difficult. That's what they're playing is not that hard. It's like, yeah, cool. Here's a guitar. Go nuts. And then people realize, oh, shit. Okay, hang on a minute. They're doing something real weird here. and
it's like Meshuggah, the Meshuggah track Bleed. Oh. The drum part, it sounds simple, but then when you break it down, he's like, hang on a minute, he's playing like 16th note triplets with his feet. Mm-hmm. There's like 4/4 with the crash cymbal, and then the snare is on some other weird timed signature. Mm-hmm. It's the sort of thing that could probably only be composed on a computer, which is how Thomas Harker does all these drum parts, mm-hmm. and then he has to come around and try and play them.
Mm, mm, mm.
So apparently when he first tried to play Meshuggah's Bleed, he couldn't do it. It's like, how the hell are we? And now he's like, you watch him perform, it's just insane.
Yeah, the amount of concentration on his face when he's playing that song too.
Oh, 100%.
It's like one of the only Meshuggah songs where he's actually sitting there going, fucking, I need to nail this, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
Yeah, Dance of Eternity is kind of the same with Dream Theater as well. They kind of really have to, you know, concentrate on what's going on with that one.
Yeah, and I suppose
They always have to concentrate on going on, with that one even more so.
Well, I suppose that's what is so interesting, I find, about Tool is the way that they put things together makes everything sound so simple. You know, there's this stuff that's in like, I think it's Tempest. The beginning of that song is in 5/8, 5/8, 5/8, 6/8. Right. So you've got like the actual groupings of what he's playing is in, it's not 5/8, 5/8. It's a group of five, group of five, group of five, group of six. Right. And he's playing pretty well 16th notes on it. Right. So, you know, so you've probably got 10/8 and then 11/8 is probably the time signature with those. Right. Or 5/4 and 11/8 being all things somewhat being equal. But for them to then do what they do with that, and then you've got that chimey bell thing that comes in over the top, the ding-ding, ding-ding, ding, it's doing that, and then you've got the bass build up and the drums come in over the top and everything, and it's just like you're sitting there by the end of it going, what the fuck? How do you come up with that? You know, and it's just...
And less significantly, how the hell are you going to play it live?
Yeah, and that's... But this is the thing, right? Every single time I've seen them play, they do a song and I go, oh, this will be interesting to see how they do it. And they pull it off and you go, how the fuck? How did you fucking do that? You know, and it's just Danny Carey, he is a monster. He is a monster of a drummer, right? And the stuff he's playing doesn't sound particularly difficult. You know, it's just like, oh, so he doesn't have the snare wires engaged. I can do that. It's like, yeah, but do you realize he's playing like three polyrhythms at the moment? And he's also managing to keep everyone else in time. And they're actually following him, unlike how everything... It's just... It's mind-bending. It really is. And I suppose that what's really special for me about this album is that it's an album that has been released where I've actually been excited for this Tool album, because I only got on the Tool bandwagon probably about 6 months after 10,000 Days was released. So I didn't get to do the hype and everything like that. Whereas I've seen this one come through. And I don't know, I just, as I said before, it's exactly everything that I wanted out of a Tool album, and I'm happy. I'm just happy about it.
Fair enough. I think there's also as well, it's like there's, you know, we've talked about this before, like the cottage industry of people wanting to like bash the thing because that's what you do. You know, let's say it's rubbish. Let's say it's crap just for funsies, you know? Or because it's the thing to do, and there's always more money in outrage.
Well, that's true. That's true.
But, yeah, I don't know. My initial impression of this album was that I found it to be really boring. But maybe that's just because I need to listen to it more.
Possibly. But it's okay not to like it as well. I want to put that out there as well, despite the jeering and so on and so forth that goes on. It's okay not to like it. If you don't like it, it doesn't matter. But don't stop someone else enjoying it. You know, and that's the issue I have with the guys online where they get on there and they're, oh, it's shit because of this and it should have been this and it should have been that. So, man, if you don't like it, just put on there, I didn't really like it, you know, but that's cool. And equally, the people that like it can't turn around to the other people and go, well, you're a dickhead for not liking it.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
But that happens in every fandom. How can you possibly like this record when you don't like this record? How can you be...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah,
the other part of this main topic as well that we were going to discuss was some other albums that came out on the same day to try and give a bit of coverage to the poor bastards that decided to put their records out on the same day as the Tool record, where pretty much the entire prog community wasn't going to be paying quite that much attention.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So one record that we have already discussed on this show a couple of times is Magic Pie, Fragments of the Fifth Element. Mm-hmm. This one is probably more up my alley because it's kind of just good classic prog rock. If you yep. liked the album review that Dave gave me last time, The Man Who Had It All, mm-hmm. if you like that song, you'll enjoy the rest of the record.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you'll enjoy that one.
I mean, you've obviously basically said it's a good classic prog rock album. You'll enjoy mm-hmm. it. Was there anything in particular stand out for you with the Magic Pie album?
I like the keyboard sounds, actually. Mm. I really enjoy the keyboard sounds.
Yeah, yeah, actually.
It's kind of a bit, you know, there's a lot of bands out there where, and Rick Wakeman has made a point about this. He's like, when I listen to prog now, he could be like, oh, right, okay, you've just used like the standard Korg chrono, like a sound that comes preloaded in the Korg Chronos, or oh, that's from this, or that's from that.
Yeah.
But there's no like, not like, okay, not everybody can go to the same level that Jordan Rudess goes to, where he's like full into sound mixing and layering and stacking, and in my right hand I have a massive organ sort of thing. Few probably have the time to go into that or to go to the same level as, say, like a Mark Kelly, for example, where he's very much in the same sort of mode where using lots of plugins and synths to try and create new sounds. Because I doubt many have the time for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Especially if you're writing by jamming or whatever. So if you're going to that, like, but I think these guys do. They are trying to sort of mix different synth sounds and not just have like the standard sound. Mm. You know, here's a Hammond organ, or here's a Mellotron, or here's like a, you know, a Synclavier or something like that.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed Magic Pie.
Mm. Yeah. And also as well, you know, in classic prog style, the last track on the album is more than 20 minutes long because of course it is.
Absolutely. And that's, it's a great album. And you know what, if you do like your classic prog rock and things like that, Magic Pie is definitely right up there. They're incredible. They're an incredible band. And this album's actually quite enjoyable.
The other one that I wanted to call out as well, it's an album by an Australian artist, mm-hmm. I believe. Now, I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce her surname, but I'm going to give it a go anyway. It's Alana XO, I think. It's just the name on the record is just Alana and then XO, and her debut album, 11.
Mm.
Now, if you are someone who likes instrumental prog, kind of almost like kind of post rock music, if you're into that sort of vibe, check this record out. It's a very, very cool album. Even just to kind of have on in like the background. I know some people have a really terrible way of like they don't like listening to music just in the background. But this one's quite cool, actually. It's a really interesting album. Lots of kind of instrumental prog post rock kind of stuff, but also with just like field recordings as well, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, just like found sounds and stuff. So if you're into that sort of music, you give that record a go.
Yeah,
you might enjoy that.
It's also worth noting that with this album, she actually played everything on it.
Yeah,
so
yeah, absolutely.
All the guitars,
everything.
All the
guitars, keyboards, drums, all that.
Everything mm-hmm. is all her. She's an incredibly gifted muso, and it's definitely worth checking this album out. You can check that out on Bandcamp, and all the stuff we're talking about today, as always, will be in the show notes.
Absolutely. Although, some Bandcamp links, some Spotify links. Mm-hmm.
Just depends what's
always
there.
I always try and link to Bandcamp wherever I can get away mm-hmm. with it, because then it gives people an opportunity to actually buy the thing if they like it.
Exactly, and as what we talk about,
that's not always possible. Sometimes they don't have Bandcamp pages, so we go to Spotify.
Yeah, exactly. A couple
so
of
you've got
ones
a couple
that,
more in here.
Yeah, so there was one, two that was sort of similar style and one that wasn't. So I'll start with the one that wasn't, and that was the Revel Abstract Incomplete. I'm assuming it was supposed to be incomplete, but they've missed an E off the end. So Incomplete.
Possibly.
Is how I'm going to say that. Kind of cool. It had this Coheed and Cambria vibe sort of mixed with Polaris.
Yeah, I definitely got more of the Polaris vibe.
Yeah, the Coheed was coming through, I think, with the vocals. They were really that, you know, sort of high-pushed kind of stuff, which, it was okay. I'll admit the standout track on it is Nihilism, which I think was the second track or something like that. The album itself though was really poorly mixed.
That might just be because it's on YouTube and it's kind of like a lower quality kind of thing.
No,
I don't know.
Look, that could very well be it, but it did sound like there were some tops missing from the guitars. It sounded like it wasn't necessarily, maybe it wasn't mastered. I'm not sure. But it sounded a bit, easiest way to describe it was that they sounded trapped in the speakers. It didn't sound like it was coming out of the speakers, which is generally a bad mixing job, but I could be wrong. But otherwise, good track, good album. Not very many views on YouTube and such, so definitely go and check that out. Give them some views, give them some likes. The one for me that was really cool, though, was Antoine Farfard, I think is how you say his name, Antoine Farfard, which was just instrumental jazz fusion. It was awesome. It really reminded me of the Pilot Wings soundtrack from the N64 back in the day, and I really, really enjoyed it. And there was another one as well, another instrumental jazz sort of fusion-y kind of thing by Louis Demule, I think is how you say his name. Again, jazz fusion, incredibly tight, precise instrumental album, definitely worth it. What I do find really interesting is that of all of these albums, there was nothing on there that was even remotely in the same league as Tool, as in same, not league as in people or status or anything like that, but the same sound. So obviously people knew to stay away from it, because somehow I don't imagine the people listening to jazz fusion and such are necessarily going to be listening to Tool. Then again, I could be completely wrong.
Of the records that we've listed today, the Magic Pie one is obviously the one that I enjoyed the most. But Alana Xoa's album is also very good.
Yeah. So I think, from us here, just really quickly back on the Tool album, for me, I'm going to go 4.8 out of 5 for this album for me, which is a very big score. I loved it. It's just over it. It was just amazing. Hoggy, should we hang off on your scoring until you give it another listen?
Yeah, I think so. All right.
That's cool.
Otherwise, I'm just going to give it a really low score and people are going to get really shitty with me.
Of course they are. They're prog heads.
Oh, well, yeah.
Now, despite this episode being basically a big album review, I think now it's time for the album reviews.
Now, the record that I gave to you last time was Shadow Gallery's self-titled album from 1992. What did you think, Dave?
I'm surprised it was an album from 1992. It sounded like it belonged in the mid-80s.
Yeah, it was their debut album. There's probably parts of it that probably were recorded in the mid-80s,
possibly. It really reminded me of when Dream and Day Unite, like that sound, you know, that kind of...
There's definitely an early 90s prog sound.
Or late 80s, maybe.
Rightly or wrongly, possibly maybe people were chasing Queensryche a little bit on that
possibly,
one.
Possibly, maybe.
And the Dream Theater was certainly influenced by Queensryche.
Yeah, absolutely. I enjoyed the album. I really, really did. My favorite track off the whole album was Darktown. The way it started and finished and sort of progressed through the entire, was it 7 minutes or whatever it is? I really liked it. I really, really, really did like it. Surprisingly, I wasn't a huge fan of the last track.
That's
something
interesting.
In the Ice Queen or blah, 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 or something like that.
The Queen of the City of Ice.
That's it, Queen of the City of Ice.
That's interesting because that is my favorite on the record.
Oh, that's interesting because for me it was a bit too drony. You know, it's sort of, it felt like it could have had about 3 minutes shaved off it. But that's just
okay.
Me.
Okay, interesting.
I don't know. I just, it didn't gel with me with that. But that being said, fantastic album. Definitely, probably, you know, 3.5 to 4 out of 5, somewhere around there. Would definitely recommend going and checking it out. One thumb up, or 1.5 thumbs up, I suppose, from me. It was good. It was really, really good.
Fair enough. Now, the one that you gave to me was an album by a band called Socionic, Dividing Horizon. I enjoyed this record. There was a lot of technical guitar work that I quite enjoyed.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of big solos. I like the vocals on it. It's an interesting record. Definitely be coming back to that one, that's for sure.
Yeah, I thought it was a I thought it was a really, really cool album, and that's why, like, when I heard it, it was just I had my Spotify on, you know, as Spotify does, it sort of flips through different things, and when you finish a playlist, it just starts playing stuff that's sort of in the ballpark. And this one came up, and I went, "Oh, hello! I'm at that. That is what I'm all about." So yeah, so I'm glad you enjoyed it. What are we talking? We're talking sort of 3 out of 5.
I tend to go for thumbs up and thumbs down when it comes to these records.
That's cool.
But yeah, I'd give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, thumbs up.
I find it really hard to quantify records out of 5 and out of 10 and stuff. So
yeah, that's fair. Yeah,
just go along with that.
That's fair. Yeah, excellent. So I suppose, what have you got for me this week?
So the record I have for you is actually from friend of the show, Malcolm Galloway. He has a new EP out.
I was going to say, is this another Hats Off Gentlemen? It's Adequate album?
Yes, it is.
Yes! All right, sweet.
It's not an album this time around. It's an EP.
Oh, okay, yep.
The EP is called Arc.
Okay.
It contains 3 songs. Mm-hmm. They're all sort of tied together in a bit of a story.
Mm-hmm.
Have a listen to that. Tell me what you think.
Okay, absolutely will. I really enjoyed the last one, so I'm definitely going to be all over this one. So for you this week, I've discovered a new Aussie prog band for you to check out. These guys are called Sky Signals. They're actually from Sydney, believe it or not. And their album is called Illumine? I don't know. It's kind of sort of like Illuminate, but not.
Okay.
And it was released at the tail end of last year. And it's there for you to listen to. You can check that out, I think, on their Bandcamp. They've also got it on Spotify for ease of listen for all those listening and playing along at home. And not to sort of spoil anything, but I am actually going to be chatting to these guys sometime next week as well discuss this album and to discuss their future plans. So they're going to be joining us right here on the 9-8 podcast. Very
fantastic.
Soon.
All right.
So
give
there
a listen
we go.
To that record.
So I think that wraps it up.
Yeah, it does. It does. If you'd like to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the98podcast.fireside.fm/38.
Mm-hmm.
You can find us on Twitter at 98fm or one word. And drop us a line in we have our email contact form on our website at the98podcast.fireside.fm.
Beautiful.
Please get in touch with us. Please send us your feedback. We'd love to read and receive feedback.
Absolutely.
From all of you out there.
Absolutely. Also another, one last little thing I will put on here. If anyone here listens to Progzilla Radio, which is an online radio station out of the UK, the wonderful Emma Roebuck recently had me on the show. I believe it's going live sometime in the next week or so. So keep your ears peeled for that, and we'll throw a link in the show notes below as to where you can actually listen to that interview as well.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. So as always, thank you so much for joining us and listening to us talk about probably what has been the most anticipated metal album of probably the last 10 years, I think. Probably the last 15 years, let's be really honest.
Yeah, I'd go along with that.
Until next time, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. My name's Dave Ellis.
My name is Alex Hogg. See you later.